only to me? Did my siblings reach fundamentally different conclusions about how to think about life from their observations of our parents? Who knows? And not to be too glib, but to a certain extent, who cares? What really matters when you have depression is not why you have it, but what to do about it. That I'm the only runner in my family might not be a fluke. There's solid evidence supporting my decision to become one. The case for running as a treatment for depression. Over the past couple of decades, there's been a growing body of research on exercise as a potential form of treatment for depression. Almost all of this research uses aerobic exercise, of which running is a form, as the treatment. In Chapter 4, we'll look in detail at whether running is singularly effective compared to other forms of exercise. These studies tend to divide previously sedentary people with depression into two or more groups and see how various forms of treatment affect their depressive symptoms at the end of the study. Some studies have just two groups, a control group that remains sedentary and a group that begins an exercise program. Other studies compare exercise to common treatments, such as antidepressants and psychotherapy, while the control group receives a placebo. For example, a famous Duke University study divided 202 adults with major depression into four groups receiving different treatment. Supervised exercise in a group setting, unsupervised home-based exercise, the antidepressant sertraline, brand name Zoloft, or a placebo pill. The subject's level of depression was retested at the end of the 16-week study. After the 4 months of treatment, 41% of the subjects no longer met the clinical standards for major depression, with this being the key detail. The two groups of exercisers improved as much as the people who took antidepressants. These groups all improved more than the control group. In a follow-up study, the researchers checked in on the subjects 1 year after the end of the first study, for example, 16 months after the beginning of the first study. The researchers found that the people who continued to exercise regularly during that year had, on average, the biggest decrease in depressive symptoms. Studies such as these support the idea that exercise can be as effective as antidepressants in relieving symptoms of depression. This idea was bolstered by a review of research on the topic published in 2017. In contrast to original research, such as the Duke University studies, research reviews look at all well-designed research on a topic to identify commonly reached conclusions. The 2017 review found that the Duke studies weren't a fluke. All these studies reported that exercise and standard antidepressant treatments were equally effective, the review states. The most well-known review of research on exercise for depression is called the Cochrane Review. Updated as new studies are done, it includes results from research on people with mild to moderate as well as major depression. The most recent version pools the results from 39 studies, with a total of more than 2,300 subjects. Its main take-home finding for our purposes is that exercise was as effective as antidepressants and psychotherapy in reducing depressive symptoms. Other research supports using exercise in conjunction with other treatments. The main types of those treatments are the subject of several later chapters. There's also evidence that regular exercise can prevent developing depression. A Norwegian study followed almost 34,000 adults over a 9 to 13 year period. At the beginning of the study, none had symptoms of depression. During the study period, 7% of the subjects developed symptoms meriting a diagnosis of depression. The researchers also collected data on the subjects' exercise habits at the beginning and end of the study. Those who got no regular exercise were an astounding 44% more likely to develop depression than those who exercised for 1 to 2 hours a week. The design of the study is significant because by including only people who weren't depressed at the outset, It removed the possibility that subjects who were sedentary were that way because of depression. Another point concerning the link between being sedentary and depression: inactivity increases the risk of developing common conditions, such as heart disease and diabetes, which might further the risk of developing depression. Despite the ever-growing amount of evidence for exercise as a treatment for depression, resistance remains. Some of the pushback against exercise as medicine stems from the reasonable point that you often can't get people to do it. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Population, only 21% of the U.S. population gets the recommended 150 minutes, 2.5 hours of light to moderate aerobic exercise per week. It's also reasonable to point out that people suffering from depression might have an especially hard time getting themselves to work out for half an hour 5 days a week. But for many regular runners, these modest recommendations are probably not an issue. 15 minutes a week at a pace of 10 minutes per mile gets you to 150 minutes. Another reason given for skepticism about exercise's efficacy is study methodology. Refuting that skepticism requires a brief detour on the topic of research in general. The gold standard for peer-reviewed research is what's known as a double-blind study, in which neither the subjects nor the researchers know which subjects got which treatment. So, for example, when testing a new medication, you'd have half of the subjects get the medication and half get a placebo that's indistinguishable from the medication in terms of appearance, taste, and so on. You would distribute the medication such that the people taking and administering the medication couldn't tell who got the medication and who got the placebo. This design lessens the chance that perceptions of the medication's effects will influence the subject's reactions to it and the researcher's interpretation of those reactions. Double-blind studies are simply not possible for some areas of investigation, including exercise. If you're depressed and sedentary and agree to take part in a study on whether exercise reduces your depressive symptoms, you'll know whether you were part of the group that started exercising or whether you were in the control group that remained sedentary. You might then report feeling better after 6 weeks of working out because you've heard that exercise helps with depression. Your expectation of a benefit might produce that benefit. The phenomenon of getting better because you expect to get better is an example of the placebo effect. The phrase placebo effect is often used dismissively. For example, a runner's faster race times soon after switching to a new coach are said to be a placebo effect because she couldn't have gotten that much fitter in 2 weeks. Researchers, in contrast, acknowledge the validity of the placebo effect. It's a powerful reminder of the role our mind plays in how our body feels. That's especially the case for depression, which isn't as easily diagnosed as a physical malady such as kidney disease. Researchers attempt to account for the placebo effect in designing studies. In testing a new medication, they'll expect some of the people who get the placebo to report some of the same effects as the people taking the medication. What they'll be looking for is whether the effects reported by the people taking the medication are significantly different in both type and degree from those reported by the placebo group. In testing whether exercise helps people with depression, the placebo effect is accounted for by giving the sedentary control group an inefficacious pill. This method has been used for other forms of treatment where it's impossible to hide whether you're getting the treatment, such as talk therapy. The takeaway from this tutorial: in studies designed like this, the people who start exercising report more improvement than the control group. In discussing an earlier version of the Duke University Exercise versus Zoloft study, John Rady, MD, writes in his book, Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, the results should be taught in medical school and driven home by health insurance companies and posted on the bulletin boards of every nursing home in the country, where nearly a fifth of the residents have depression. Unfortunately, that's not how it works in the United States. The U.S. medical system might have some built-in barriers to exercise being viewed as a viable, standalone treatment. It remains the case that physicians are trained more to deal with disease than to promote health. We go to a doctor's office not to learn how to live life to its fullest, but because something is wrong with us. We go with the expectation that the doctor has something to offer, a prescription, a test or two, a referral to a specialist, above and beyond what we can do on our own. Understandably, most doctors probably feel that they should offer something reflecting their education and experience. The doctor saying, "Try getting outside and moving your body for half an hour most days, then come see me in 6 weeks," isn't how a typical office visit plays out for either party. The more cynical among us might also mention how pharmaceutical companies promote the idea that there's a pill to pop for most maladies. Current guidelines by groups such as the American Psychiatric Association and the American College of Physicians don't count exercise as what's known as a first-line treatment, or an initial form of treatment a physician should recommend for a patient with depression. Modern antidepressants and some forms of psychotherapy are the two main first-line treatments. On a patient portion of its website, the National Institute of Mental Health includes exercise in a section called Beyond Treatment, Things You Can Do, along with things like set realistic goals for yourself and continue to educate yourself about depression. In contrast, guidelines in countries such as the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and Canada recommend that clinicians view exercise as a first-line treatment. Canada, for example, recommends exercise as an initial standalone treatment for mild to moderate depression and a second-line or next-round treatment in conjunction with other treatments for more severe cases. Guidelines in Australia and New Zealand view exercise even more favorably. Incorporating the evidence for inactivity contributing to depression, the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists guidelines consider exercise a step zero treatment. That is, a sedentary depressed patient in Sydney or Auckland will first be encouraged to start working out. Only if regular exercise proves to be insufficient will the U.S. go-tos of medication and psychotherapy be tried. Back in the U.S., exercise as medicine might be an instance in which patients lead and standard practice catches up. Ideally, more physicians and clinicians will hear from the people they treat how running and other forms of exercise help them manage depression. Here's one such story. Becoming depressed, becoming a runner. Unlike many with the condition, I've never been majorly incapacitated by depression. Most people would consider me productive, accomplished, perhaps even energetic, given that my lifetime running odometer is past 110,000 miles. I have dysthymia, chronic low-grade depression. The literal translation is ill-humored. I liken dysthymia to the rusty coil sensation I deal with where my left hamstring attaches to the pelvis. It's been with me for decades. It's almost never bad enough to merit time off, but it's always there in the background. And if I'm not diligent about self-care, it goes from manageable to miserable. Like the hamstring insertion discomfort, my dysthymia and I have been together a long time. I was always a moody kid. When I'd go into one of what she called my funks, my mother would ask, "What's wrong?" "I don't know, I just feel sad," I'd answer, which usually produced the response, "Well, snap out of it." Nothing horrible ever happened. I was never abused, we weren't destitute, no one close to me died. I had friends and siblings to do things with, I was good at school. But nothing special ever happened either. 2 p.m. on a gray March Tuesday is my image of childhood. The current me, in my mind's eye, started to crystallize in ninth grade. A few key things happened that school year. I became more goal-oriented, I got ruminatively depressed, and I started running. That they all happened at roughly the same time isn't a coincidence. One day in biology class, the topic was freshwater ecosystems. Among the creatures we learned about was the mayfly. The species in our reading was one in which the adult stage lasts 24 hours. Nymphs emerge from water as adults, mate, and die within the space of a day. Adults don't have the capacity to eat because they don't need to. I was barely able to do my homework that night. The life cycle of the mayfly saddened me in a way that nothing had before. What was the point, I wondered, of being born, only to live long enough to produce the next generation of similarly doomed mayflies? Why couldn't the mayflies live for 48 hours, so that they could have a day to enjoy themselves before mating and dying? It then struck me that the two-day existence didn't really have much more meaning, nor three, nor four, nor... I had long observed my family, wondering why we did what we did, especially on weekends when the usual routines of school and work were absent. How did we choose to spend our time? Often, it seemed we were doing things simply to fill the hours between meals, and soon enough, the weekend would be over, and we'd be back to not having to think of things to do. And what was the point of that, I wondered, any more than the mayfly and its sad 24-hour life cycle? Years later, I learned the word Weltschmerz. Its literal translation from the German is world, Welt, pain, Schmerz. It refers to sadness over the gap between how you'd like the world to be and reality. If I'd known it in ninth grade, I would have gone to school the next day with a note reading, "Please excuse Scott's mood. He's experiencing mayfly-induced Weltschmerz." Pangs of disappointment over the underlying unsatisfactory nature of life have been with me ever since. Patients with an intellectual inclination may belabor themes of alienation and the absurdities of the human condition. The book Dysthymia and the Spectrum of Chronic Depression warns therapists. Around this time, I began to set ambitious goals. Instead of being a good student, I'd get straight A's. Instead of almost always going to school, I'd have perfect attendance. Instead of schlepping along in Boy Scouts because I liked camping, I'd become an Eagle Scout. Without understanding it at the time, I now realize I did this because of the burgeoning dysthymia. My version of depression's second main feature is anhedonia, a diminished ability to experience pleasure. These goals were ways to feel more engaged with what I'd be doing anyway. It wasn't as if there were tons of enjoyable activities that school and other forms of hurdle hopping were keeping me from, so why not set the hurdles a little higher to better occupy myself? It was also around this time that I first got drunk, smoked pot, and had a girlfriend. Now here were things that addressed anhedonia and Weltschmerz. With concentrated listening, the right music could also bring great pleasure by taking me somewhere I wasn't being dragged down by the usual "we're all mayflies" thoughts. Running was the other big novelty of those days. I'd had small tastes of it in gym class, where one option during the track and field unit was to jog the perimeter of the school grounds rather than long jump or sprint. Doing so was enjoyable. As it happened, one of my sisters had a friend who had been the state cross-country champion. He had run the local JC's Walk for Humanity 20-mile fundraiser. That impressed me more than his state championship. The idea of being so capable and independent was captivating. Throughout my childhood, I'd often felt that I wanted to be doing something different, but I didn't know what it was. Now, I did. High school and organized competition didn't start until 10th grade, but I knew I was going to go out for the cross-country team, so I started running on March 1, 1979, in the spring of 9th grade. I was soon doing 10 and 12 milers, and sometimes running twice a day. Like my teen forays into sex, drugs, and rock and roll, running countered anhedonia and Weltschmerz. It was invigorating mentally and physically while I did it, and in the afterglow, I was briefly freed from yearning for a better elsewhere. Running also gave structure to the day and imparted meaning to otherwise banal matters, such as what and when to eat. Even my mother, who was not elated that her teen son disappeared to who knows where an hour or two a day, and had become really skinny, appreciated running's mental health effects. When my aura of sourness became too overwhelming, she'd say, "Why don't you go for a run?" When I got to high school and started training with the team, running became even more key to my well-being. Two of the guys I ran thousands of miles with back then remained close friends. At road races, I became friendly with adult runners who gave me hope that running could be part of my long-term future. Running became a dependable source of pleasure and relief that partly by providing structure to my days, always provided something to look forward to. I knew I'd finally found a way to make life more livable, run by run, day by day. What I didn't know was that I was changing the very structure of my brain. Building a better brain. In my early days of running, I discovered, and reveled in, its effects on my mood. It was amazing to leave the house and return just 30 minutes later feeling more energetic, optimistic, engaged, and happy. And doing so didn't require talking my brother into buying me beer. That immediate and dependable boost in mood is one of running's great attractions, regardless of your mental health. Short-term relief is especially captivating for runners with depression. In Chapter 4, we'll look in detail at why any given run makes you feel so much better, and how best to get that benefit. But where running really helps with depression is over time, thanks to changes in brain structure. According to Panteleimon Ekakakis, Ph.D., a researcher and professor of exercise psychology at Iowa State University, regular running produces the same two changes that are thought to be responsible for the effectiveness of modern antidepressants, increased levels of the neurotransmitters serotonin and norepinephrine, and neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells. As Laura Fredendahl says, "The daily hits matter, but over time there's a cumulative effect. You're actually building a healthier brain. And a healthier brain's going to feel better." Much of this change happens in the hippocampus, an area of the brain that's often shrunken in people with depression. According to Ekakakis, MRI scans have shown that even after a 6-month exercise intervention, there's a visible increase in the size of the hippocampus. Reinforcing the uncertainty about the causes of depression, Ekakakis says, "The hippocampus is primarily involved in memory." We don't understand why growth in an area of the brain that appears to be involved with memory would somehow contribute to an antidepressant effect, but there seems to be a link. That regular running causes structural changes in the brain is the most important thing I learned writing this book. It makes sense once you think about it. Why wouldn't there be noticeable differences over time in the brain? In the same way that a chest x-ray shows that the left ventricle of my heart has enlarged over decades of running. But growing the brain by running isn't something you often hear about. Discussions of its mental health benefits tend to focus on day-to-day effects, implying that using running to manage depression is a Sisyphean task that starts from scratch with each sunrise. Research says otherwise. Running produces neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, improvements in the brain's internal communications network. Neurogenesis and neuroplasticity appear to occur primarily due to brain-derived neurotrophic factor, the protein briefly discussed in the previous chapter. Trophic, in this context, means promoting survival and growth of the brain cells known as neurons. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, is often called the miracle grow of the brain. It helps neurons fire and wire together, Fredendahl says. The hippocampus, with its mysterious link to depression, is a key area of BDNF activity. Increased levels of BDNF appear to encourage both new growth and better functioning of existing neurons that are involved in serotonergic transmission. Again, this mechanism of increasing the availability of neurotransmitters, such as serotonin, is exactly what modern antidepressants aim to achieve. BDNF levels sharply increase after any given workout, or more accurately, any aerobic workout, such as running. Most research hasn't found that such activities as strength training boost BDNF levels. This acute increase in BDNF levels during a run is part of why you can almost guarantee you'll return from a run in a better mood. But where we runners really get help is over time. People who exercise regularly have greater BDNF increases per workout than less committed exercisers. For each run, you get more of the good stuff. Your other reward for regularity, there's research indicating that frequent exercisers have higher BDNF levels at rest than do sedentary people. So even when you're not running, the fact that you do so regularly is bettering your brain. Of course, you probably don't possess charts of your typical BDNF levels before and since you became a runner. What you do have are your subjective experiences. Reflecting on them might help you realize that more time as a runner can mean less interference from depression. Neurogenesis from running also occurs in the prefrontal cortex, Fredendall says. That's a super important part of the brain. People who are stress resilient show more activity in the left side of the prefrontal cortex. Running and doing other hard things where you push yourself increases activity in the prefrontal cortex. Over time, that builds a brain that's better able to regulate itself. Or, as a review of research published in Clinical Psychology Review put it, exercise training recruits a process which confers enduring resilience to stress. There's another key physiological way that running helps depression. It occurs by the seeming paradox of expending energy to feel more energetic. Activation saves the day. I once explained the lethargy of depression to my brother by asking him what he does when he's thirsty. He gave me a duh look and said, "Get something to drink." I said, "It's not always that simple." I told him I might feel thirsty and think I should go to the kitchen and get some water. Then I might imagine rising from a chair, walking to another room, getting a glass, and turning on the faucet. Often, I said, picturing myself going through that process leads to the thought, "That's a lot of work. Stay put until you're ready." This prehearsal of desired activities before deciding not to do them sounds strange to people like my brother, but brings nods of understanding from people with depression. Fatigue is often listed as a symptom of depression. I don't think that's quite the right word. Fatigue is being 17 miles into a hilly 20-miler when your longest run in the last 2 months was 14 miles. Perceived fatigue more accurately captures the phenomenon of thinking about doing something and postponing doing it until you feel you have enough energy. Initiative can be especially lacking if your depression includes a feeling of meaninglessness. Why bother getting up and doing something if your efforts don't matter? Inertia can take on a life of its own. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, after all, which leads to feeling that much droopier. Running is a daily way to break free from lassitude. Getting out the door changes the narrative and creates momentum. I think of running as helping depression through activation, through the improved energy that comes from running, says clinical psychiatrist Brian Vasey. Fredendall says of people with depression, "I have not had a patient who wouldn't benefit from increasing their activity level. When you're depressed, your brain is more turned off. Going for a run activates your brain cells. Having that wake-up experience can make you feel better. In my early days of running, I often struggled with activation. I'd picture myself 5 miles from home and think, 'Not yet, wait until you're up for it.' This happened even though I knew that the magical infusion of energy I was waiting for would come only by doing the thing I was finding reasons to avoid. I seldom have these silly procrastination battles now. I have decades more evidence that just a few miles will energize mind and body like nothing else. Another key is internalizing the lesson that something is better than nothing in these situations. That's another way of saying when you know you need a run, don't visualize yourself 5 miles from home. On my worst days with depression, I tell myself all that's required is a token run at no faster than a stumble. If you feel worse after 10 minutes, the internal monologue goes, you can go home. You can probably guess that I almost always stay out longer and return home feeling victorious. To bridge the gap between hibernating sloth and runner in motion, I picture myself going to bed that night. As I turn off the light, will I be happier that I got myself to run? Of course. I also find a way to change into my running clothes and start my pre-run routine of stretching and other exercises. On particularly tough days, I tell myself all I have to do in the immediate future is some gentle stretching, which will feel better if I'm wearing running gear. This low level of activity starts the energizing process. Seeing myself outside and in motion begins to seem possible. Fredendahl will sometimes have a patient stand and join her in breathing exercises or arm swings to get a slight activation effect. Rich Harfst has also learned over the years that running can be most helpful when it seems least likely. After competing in high school and college, he was a self-described fitness runner for the first part of his professional life. When he began to run again after back surgery in 2004, he decided to resume racing, and now, in his 50s, is trying to break 3 hours for the marathon. I've achieved a point, knock on wood, where I'm pretty good at heading it off, Harfst says of days-long depressive episodes that used to be more common. The worst periods are now down to a matter of days, where I just fight my way out of it. That's where running comes in. I stay consistent, even on really bad days. Something might happen, and I might crawl in a hole and go to bed for a while, but I'll get out of bed and go for a run, just because I don't want to put a zero in my training log. It slowly starts to bring me out on the other side. The just-do-it approach isn't to belittle the struggles of runners who sometimes miss days, even though they know running will energize them. Rob Krar is a 2-time winner of the Western States Endurance Run, a 100-miler that's considered the most prestigious ultramarathon in the United States. Yet, even he sometimes finds himself dressed to run and simply unable to step through the door to a better day. I don't have that magic wand to wave and get myself out of it, the Flagstaff, Arizona resident says. Sometimes I can, and sometimes I can't. Ian Kellogg is another fast runner whose competitive goals aren't enough to activate him when his depression is especially bad. More often than not, I don't run on those days, even though I know that just half an hour will make me feel better, the Otterbein University cross-country ace says. I can't find the energy or willpower to get out the door. Kellogg's father, John, is also a runner. He's often Ian's escort out of the negative feedback loop of inactivity. My dad will say, come jog a few miles with me, Ian says. He understands what's going on in my head. My best memories are going on runs with my dad and talking, or sometimes not talking at all. If he does that a few times, that helps me get out of my funk, or it at least sparks a drive for me to get running again, and then I'm usually able to get back to normal. Conventional wisdom advises arranging runs with others for people who lack consistency, on the theory that you're less likely to blow off a run if you know someone is waiting for you. Fredendahl would approve of the elder Kellogg's wiliness in applying this advice to his son's depression. If you're depressed, you might be more likely to show up for someone else than you are to show up for yourself, she says. Tricking yourself in this way means activation, and the relief from depressive symptoms that comes with it. It can also lead to a feeling of self-efficacy, another key way in which running helps people with depression. Spreading self-efficacy. The short and long-term effects of running on your brain and body are profound. But levels of chemicals in your brain are only part of your mental state. There's also cognition, mental processes. Cognition includes not just straightforward thinking, I should run long today because a blizzard is coming tomorrow, but also more involved phenomena, such as how you think about your thoughts. A hallmark of depression is self-defeating, absolutist thinking. Everything is harder than it should be. There's no pleasure in my life. It doesn't matter what I do. It's always going to be like this. Running gives us regular opportunities to prove those thoughts wrong and thereby feel better and feel better about ourselves. For people with depression, a big psychological benefit from running is a boost in self-esteem, Vasey says. Having been able to set a goal and reach it brings confidence. As Amelia Gappin from New Jersey says, if I knock out 10 miles before work, I feel like I'm on a high the rest of the day. Fredendall agrees that this psychological benefit of running is key. The subjective experience of seeing yourself do something can make you feel better. Success in doing the hard thing and being in a running program gives people a sense of self-efficacy. The prediction or belief in one's ability to be able to perform or accomplish a specific task or goal. That really helps with mood management for a lot of people. Over time, the self-efficacy aspect of running has become one of the sport's main aids to my life. I've learned that lacing up and hitting the roads is my best way to break free from what's the point on auto-repeat. On a daily basis, running reminds me that I can overcome apathy and torpor. Seeing that small victory, I can convince myself that progress is possible in meeting professional goals, or not feeling lonely so often, or figuring out how to afford retirement, or improving my posture. Ekakakis is also big on the benefits of self-efficacy. It's one reason that he wishes exercise were prescribed at least as often as antidepressants. If you take antidepressants and they make you better, the psychological attribution is external, he says. Patients believe that the reason they get better is because of the drug they take. People believe, I cannot even function without having to rely on this external thing that helps me get through the day. With exercise, he says, the attribution is internal. The reason I get better is because I myself try. It's not that somebody else is giving me a pill, it's that I am putting in the effort. That's where perhaps the additional benefit of exercise compared to the antidepressants lies. That sense of empowerment, that sense that I myself am taking control of my situation. Taking control of my situation is an apt description of how running has helped me manage depression. It applies at least equally as well to how running helps people with anxiety, which is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 3. How Running Helps People with Anxiety. On a long run one spring morning, a friend said she was worried about her daughter's upcoming trip to Paris. There had been a terrorist attack in the city a couple of months earlier, and my friend was worried about a repeat. I unhelpfully trotted out the usual question, "Do you worry this much every time she gets in a car? She's a lot more likely to die that way." The odds of dying in a terrorist attack segued into the friend voicing her fear of death. Love that runner's high. I continued in the hyper-rational devil's advocate role. What exactly are you afraid of? I asked. If the worst thing that can happen in any situation is that you die, then in the situation when you do die, the worst has happened, so there's nothing to fear. Even if it's really painful, it will soon be over, and then you won't have to live with the consequences and memory of that pain. My friend said it was the fear of the unknown that troubled her, what it's like while it's happening, and what happens after. I said, I'm all for worrying about known upcoming events that you can make better by prepping for. What's known as defensive pessimism is my forte. But worrying about unknowns that you have no way of learning more about and that you can do nothing to change, that just makes no sense, I said. This was not my best moment as empathetic running partner. As someone whose depressive thoughts often lack logic, I should have understood it's immaterial whether my friend's anxiety about death withstands rational analysis. That's especially true because I know that one of the main reasons my friend runs is to manage anxiety. Much of what we learned about how running helps people with depression is also true for people with anxiety. But anxiety presents its own challenges. In this chapter, we'll look at the many ways that running is highly effective in addressing those challenges. A quick overview of anxiety. As with occasionally feeling sad and having depression, it helps to distinguish worrying about things from what medically is known as anxiety disorder. The worry that underlies anxiety disorder is often nebulous, as opposed to, say, worrying about work. I talk about anxiety as agitated, uncomfortable, something not right with the world, stress that could be a feeling of threat or a feeling of worry, a feeling of discomfort that often leads to seeking out relief through different means, sometimes unhealthy means, says clinical psychiatrist Brian Vasey. These thoughts and sensations are often accompanied by physical symptoms associated with the body's fight or flight mechanism, such as increased heart rate and sweating. One factor is persistence and subsequent interference with day-to-day functioning. If someone said, "I have these symptoms, but they don't really bother me. I don't have daily physical symptoms that are distracting. I'm not spending a lot of time engaged in coping," I wouldn't diagnose that person as having an anxiety disorder, Vasey says. Clinically, anxiety has different categories, including general anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, and panic disorder. It's estimated that almost 29% of Americans will develop an anxiety disorder at some point in their life. Clinical social worker Frank Brooks says that about 20% of the population will have anxiety in a given year, underlying its chronic nature. Adding to the toll of anxiety is that it's often accompanied by depression. I more often find that anxiety and depression coexist rather than being two separate entities, with the depression frequently a result of untreated anxiety over time, Vasey says. Estimates of anxieties and depression's coexistence range from 50 to 80%. As shown by my on-the-run cluelessness discussing my friend's fear of death, I'm one of the fortunate people with depression who don't have anxiety. To get a better understanding, I asked several people who use running to manage their anxiety to describe their symptoms. Cecilia Bidwell, an attorney from Tampa, Florida, didn't experience anxiety until her mid-20s when she was in law school. "I started having these days where I was gripped by feelings of dread and terrible worry," she says. "It would always be about something specific, like a guy I was seeing at the time, who's now my husband, was deployed in Iraq, and I'd wake up some days convinced he was going to be killed. Or I'd wake up absolutely convinced I would never pass the background check to be admitted to the bar, and wouldn't be able to practice law." When she began practicing, the incidents became more frequent and less tied to specific incidents. Once, she was driving back from a meeting and had to pull off I-95 into a Whole Foods Market parking lot. "I couldn't breathe. My heart was racing. I felt like my chest was being crushed in. I thought I'd developed cardiomyopathy from running ultramarathons." Before she learned how to manage her anxiety with running and other measures of self-care, she struggled to maintain the composure and air of confidence expected of a trial attorney. "I think I did come across as something of a complete mess," she says. "I once got a less than favorable end-of-year evaluation where I was told, 'You have all this nervous energy,' and I was thinking, 'You have no freaking idea.'" Heather Johnson's anxiety began at age 13. The South Portland, Maine resident was on a plane that was delayed for hours because of a snowstorm. That triggered her first panic attack. "I was so scared, and I couldn't understand what was happening inside my body," she says. "I stood up and slapped my own face, because that's what they do in the movies to bring someone back to reality." Johnson walked off the flight and couldn't be talked back on. "I had a few more of these types of situations, and then I started to fear the fear of these situations." Johnson, who is one of my running partners, had many physical symptoms when she was young, including racing heart, sweating hands, shakiness, weakness in the knees, and dizziness. Diarrhea was a big one for me, she says, and I had an immense fear of going to the bathroom in public, which meant if this symptom popped up at any time, I panicked even more until I got home. In her mid-40s, Johnson has far fewer physical manifestations. Now I experience racing thoughts, rumination, an insatiable need to know everything that is dangerous and how to avoid it, cure it, or what will happen if I or someone I know gets it, she says. I still have some specific phobias, but I've learned to manage them so they don't keep me at home. Ian Kellogg, the Otterbein University student-athlete, has also dealt with anxiety since childhood. One way it's always shown up is that I'm a chronic overthinker, he says. I'm really physically and emotionally sensitive about things. When I was really young, I would only wear specific outfits because of how they fit on my body. The night before the first day of fifth grade, I had a breakdown and told my parents I didn't want to go to school anymore, even though there was absolutely no reason why. Another of my running partners, Meredith Anderson, whom we met in the introduction, experiences anxiety primarily as dread of the coming day, either the night before or in the morning. It's about both specific things and tomorrow as a concept, she says. There are thoughts of, you're going to fail. It's not going to go well. You're not good enough. And then it can be difficult to stop those negative thoughts having to do with self-esteem. Anderson deals with the dread by eating more than she thinks she should and by delaying going to bed. I stay up because then the next day doesn't come sooner. When the next day does come, Anderson handles it best by starting it with a run. There's good evidence backing that choice. The case for running as a treatment for anxiety. Despite anxiety being more prevalent than depression, there have been fewer studies conducted on whether exercise is an effective treatment. A partial explanation has to do with the nature of research and anxiety. Peer-reviewed studies try to have strictly defined parameters, whereas depression is typically seen as symptoms along a single spectrum, anxiety is more heterogeneous, making it more difficult to conform to a standard research model. What the research that has been done shows is that aerobic exercise, such as running, has what the experts call an anxiolytic effect, meaning that it reduces symptoms of anxiety. Workouts longer than 30 minutes are generally found to provide more benefit, and, as with most things related to running, consistency is king. Evidence from studies, such as ones on more than 8,000 Americans and 19,000 Dutch, regularly shows that regular exercisers are at less risk of being diagnosed with anxiety. Of course, these findings offer the possibility that people with anxiety might be less likely to work out regularly. If we turn instead to studies on people diagnosed with anxiety who begin working out, the findings are similarly pro-exercise. Almost three decades ago, a review of research on the topic stated, "The results substantiate the claim that exercise is associated with reductions in anxiety, but only for aerobic forms of exercise." As more studies have been conducted, regular aerobic exercise has consistently been shown to reduce anxiety symptoms compared to placebo or no treatment. This is true even when people with a chronic illness, such as heart disease or cancer, begin exercising. A 2010 review of research on such patients found that those who worked out regularly reported an average 20% reduction in their anxiety symptoms. As a 2017 review of the most up-to-date research concluded, taken together with the wider benefits of exercise on well-being and cardiovascular health, these findings reinforce exercise as an important treatment option in people with anxiety or stress disorders. Because of fewer studies on exercise and anxiety compared to exercise and depression, there's not as much data on exercise's effectiveness compared to other common forms of treatment. Still, a 2015 review of research stated, The majority of studies concluded that, as a treatment for elevated anxiety or anxiety disorders, exercise offers benefits comparable to established treatments, including medication or cognitive behavioral therapy, and better than those of placebo or waitlist control. People in a study who are told they're on a waiting list to receive the study's active treatment. The same review concluded that there are too few studies on the topic to conclude whether exercise, in addition to another form of treatment, is more effective than either treatment by itself. One key takeaway from these research reviews is that exercise, such as running, helps with both state anxiety and trait anxiety. State anxiety is a temporary manifestation of anxiety symptoms in response to a specific situation. For example, you might feel trapped upon entering a loud, crowded room and react psychologically and physically. When the specific situation no longer presents itself, in this case, when you leave the room, your symptoms go away. Trait anxiety is a more permanent aspect of personality, a tendency to regularly experience the symptoms of anxiety. You might have those symptoms to a higher degree than most people, or you might experience symptoms more often, or both. The research on exercise and trait anxiety shows significant help only with regularity. The 1991 review found that symptoms of trait anxiety didn't improve significantly until after 10 or more weeks of regular workouts. How do running and other forms of regular aerobic exercise produce these profound benefits? As with running and depression, there are thought to be several key means that work together to make exercise medicinal. A more peaceful coexistence. Remember that anxiety and depression often coexist. People with anxiety often receive prescriptions for two types of modern antidepressants: selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs. The two conditions' coexistence and presumed similar underlying agency also mean that the brain changes caused by running that we looked at in the previous chapter, increased levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, and growth in the hippocampus apply to people with anxiety as well as depression. In this view, running helps people with anxiety not just because any one workout improves their mood. Regular running helps create new brain cells and foster better communication within the brain, a structural change that helps to lessen anxiety. This idea meshes well with the finding that most people experience significant reduction in their anxiety symptoms only after several weeks of regular exercise. An animal study suggests another structural change that might help with anxiety. Researchers at Princeton University gave one group of mice unlimited access to a running wheel, while keeping another group sedentary. Mice in these situations generally run voluntarily. What else do they have to do? After 6 weeks of this setup, all the mice were briefly exposed to cold water. The researchers looked at activity in the mice's ventral hippocampus, an area of the brain that regulates anxiety, resulting from that stress. In the sedentary mice, genes from hippocampal neurons associated with stress reactions began turning on almost immediately. That didn't happen with the running mice. That was the case even though the running mice had, via exercise, generated new neurons, which are usually more excitable than older neurons. Instead, the brains of the running mice showed an increase in activities that inhibit stressful reactions, including releasing large amounts of the neurotransmitter gamma-aminobutyric acid. This neurotransmitter, known popularly as GABA, plays a major role in reducing brain cell excitability, thus providing a calming effect. Perhaps predictably, GABA supplements are sold as a stress reliever. All indications are that running gave these mice a better ability to manage stress. Findings such as these, Iowa State professor Pantoliman Ekakakis says, suggest that the anxiety-reducing effect of exercise is not merely cognitive. After all, the running mice presumably didn't fare better when exposed to the stress of cold water by telling themselves, "You can handle this. It can't be any worse than that long run in the wheel last week." That's not to downplay the cognitive aspect of running for us humans. The psychological benefits that help people with depression accrue at least as significantly for those with anxiety. Heather Johnson's experiences sync perfectly with the findings of a Southern Methodist University study. It tested whether regular exposure to exercise helps with what's known as anxiety sensitivity, which is interpreting anxiety-related sensations, such as increased heart rate and respiration, as signs of impending disaster. The participants in the study had the same success as Johnson, who says, "Running has been instrumental in pushing me into situations that trigger the same symptoms as a panic attack. It gives me ample opportunity to employ the skills necessary to abate negative self-talk, confront the fear of body symptoms, racing heart, feelings of fatigue, etc., and enjoy the moment." Johnson is also an example of increased self-efficacy via running. Formerly fearful in crowds to the point of incapacitation, she now regularly runs large road races in all their jam-packed starting corral glory. She has also managed the marketing department of a large communications firm and served on the local school board. "Every time I push outside of my comfort zone, whether running a new route and resisting the temptation to turn earlier in the run to avoid running too far away from home, or running a race and getting through the post-race fatigue, is an achievement," she says. Soothing strides. For people with depression, a benefit of running is the seeming paradox of activation. Getting up and moving makes you more energetic rather than more tired. For anxiety, running also has a potentially counterintuitive benefit. An activity that raises your heart rate and blood pressure and perspiration, which are common physical symptoms of anxiety, can be calming. Anderson says about a good pre-work run, "Whatever's going on in the day, I'm going to have a feeling like I can handle it." Ekakakis says he's unaware of specific research on the brain mechanism behind the tranquilizing effect of exercise. We do know, however, that exercise stimulates some of the peripheral effects of tranquilizers, including reductions in muscle activity typically associated with tension and anxiety. He notes that after a run, there's a drop in blood pressure, and your heart rate and systolic blood pressure don't increase in response to typical emotional stressors in the way that they do when you haven't just worked out. J. Carson Smith, the University of Maryland brain researcher we met in Chapter 1, has done some interesting work on the calming effects of exercise. In one study, he found that people were more drawn to images of pleasant faces when working out at moderate intensity than they were at rest. Smith measured this change with what's known as a dot probe task. The subjects in the study stared at a cross in the center of a computer screen designed to fix their attention. Pairs of faces, one face neutral, one either pleasant or unpleasant, appeared on each side of the center of the screen for 1 second. Then a dot appeared where one of the faces had been. The subjects were asked to locate where the dot appeared as quickly and accurately as possible. The dot probe task is a standard test for attentional bias, or paying attention to some things at the expense of others. Smith found that when the subjects were working out at a moderate intensity, they paid significantly more attention to the pleasant faces. They were more likely to accurately locate where those images had appeared on screen. Meanwhile, their attentional bias to the unpleasant faces decreased. They simply didn't notice these images as often. The subjects showed no such bias toward the pleasant faces or away from the unpleasant faces when they did the test at rest or while working out at high intensity. In another study, Smith measured people's anxiety levels on two occasions, before and after they sat peacefully for 30 minutes, and before and after they worked out at a moderate intensity for half an hour. The subjects were less anxious after both the chill-out sitting and exercise. Then came the twist. 15 minutes later, after both conditions, the subjects